August 10th, 2010, it's a Watt from Pedro show.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro Show. Actually, not from Pedro. This edition from Oslo, Norway. And also, it's my great honor and privilege to have on board with us, or with me, where are us now, Mr. Derek C. of via Chicago, North Callaway now. And I get to work with him in Stooges. And he's an incredible asset and repository of music. Fuck, sorry. Music knowing and history much more than me. And so hoping to broaden a lot from Pedro horizons with mainly blasts from past, right?
Yeah. All pre-1971 here.
Well, this is something from 1957 we started to show off. This is Thelonious Monk along with John Coltrane with Blues for Tomorrow. That's what we started to show off with. And then we heard something from the Wipers, I think 1978, Telepathic Love. It was on a EP stuffed inside the Is This Real album, I think, Without Them Knowing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Park Avenue or something. Yeah. Whatever that label was.
Yeah.
I think they put out the second record with the album cover Mr. Sage didn't approve of.
Hmm. The Youth of America?
Yeah. Yeah. And Parting of Ways over that or something.
Right.
But we were talking in the boat the other day about Wipers driving from or to someplace, and so I don't know. I thought I'd play that.
It's good music. Held up really well.
Yeah. Now, actually, you know the Stooges going way back.
Yeah. My former stepfather drummed with Iggy in 82 and 83. And I got to see some shows. And then I'll never forget, it was a big life-changing moment. Before the show, Ig was playing James Brown music, his warm-up music. And I asked my mom, who is this? And she told me it was James Brown. And, you know, I was a very precocious kid to begin with. I was big into music from an early age, thanks to mom and my uncle and various other people. They gave me a bunch of 45s and records, you know, from their youth. But I didn't have any soul
records.
But
no James Brown.
No James Brown. Okay. But I'll never forget it. And I started, you know, I would spend summers with my grandmother in Indiana, and she would take me to once a week to get a couple 45s from this oldies record store. So I started buying, you know, Motown records and whatever James Brown records I could find. And
oh, from that night?
It was tough back then. There wasn't.
But from that night, you said, I want to check this music.
Yeah.
Now, you were young?
I was 7-8 years old at that time.
Because I wanted to ask you how you got into music.
I don't even remember how. There's pictures of me when I was a toddler carrying Beatles 45s around the zoo and parks and places like that. It was just always around. My mom plays guitar and is a songwriter and had lots of records that she shared with me. So just one of those things that was kind of predetermined for me.
Do you remember the first record that you got?
I remember the first record that I physically bought, and that was the Peter Gabriel album with Games Without Frontiers on it in 1980. I'd been given a lot of records before that, but that was the first one I remember taking money that somebody gave me and buying it myself.
Yeah, because 45, there still was 45s.
Oh, yeah.
But not. By that time, it was just like punk ones.
Yeah, and then, you know, Mersch stuff.
There were still Mersch 45s early 80s?
Yeah.
Because they were big when I was young, but it seemed that records were putting those out, and the big people were, everything gravitated more towards albums because of the FM radio.
Right.
The dance records were big 12 inches.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you got the Peter Gabriel. Did you want to start playing?
Yeah, I was also,
She played guitar? That's how D. Boone got into it. His mom played guitar.
Yeah, I was, I'd learn a one-finger chord you know, every 6 months and just bash on the guitar.
Would you play her guitar?
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, I was just always picking up her guitar and playing it. So I eventually got an electric guitar of my own when I was probably 9 years old, I think. Somewhere around there.
And you got an amp?
Yeah.
Or did you just have electric guitar?
Had the little, you know, the little Fender Squire amp, you know, the whole thing.
Wow. And
yeah, that was a big thing for me.
Now, why'd you were doing the one-finger chord? Were you trying to learn off records?
Well, I think the first thing I knew how to do was, and my mom has told me this later on, was that my right hand was, I could play rhythms really well. You know, I didn't necessarily know how to change chords, but even at that real early age, I could kind of strum along with records. So.
Oh, okay. So it's a rhythm thing.
Yeah.
So you might have been able to move to drums.
Yeah, I'm a terrible drummer, so.
No, but a good right hand, I mean, strumming.
And interestingly enough, I'm left-handed with everything else.
Oh, Kay was that way. She thought the good hand was supposed to be the one finger. And
I think there's a good,
so
a good concept.
She's left-handed.
Yeah.
Thought, well, this is where the strong one should be.
Right, right.
And so she learned that bass on playing right-handed, even though she's left-handed.
Yeah.
I know with drummers it's that way, too. A lot of them play right-handed no matter they're left or right.
Yeah. So another interesting...
the kids were set up that way.
Right. So sorry to cut you off. And another interesting thing that happened around this time was there was that syndicated radio show called The Lost Lennon Tapes in the mid to late 80s where they played, you know, a lot of John Lennon demos and things like that, which I would record off of the radio every week. And one week they played him as a guest DJ on, I think it was KHJ in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And he played this record.
AM radio.
Yeah, he played this record called, oh, no. It wasn't KHJ. It was WNEW in New York. It was that one. He was guest DJ.
It's KHJ, 93 KHJ.
Right. So he was playing some of his favorite 45s, and some of them I recognized, but then he played this record called Watch Your Step by Bobby Parker. And I'd never heard that name before. You know, I thought I knew a lot about music back then. But and I looked in all my books, you know, the Rolling Stone, History of Rock and Roll. There was no mention of Bobby Parker. There was no internet back then.
Yeah.
So it was just this big mystery, and the record was so good. And I asked the guy at the oldies store that I went to. He had no idea what it was. It wasn't until many years later when I got my eBay account in the late 90s when I was able to score this record. So I'd like to share that one
first. Well, it was probably big with John Lennon.
Yeah, and it's interesting how...
He's from the old rock and roll,
yeah,
you know, right?
Yeah, well, they were big into R&B. You know, the covers on their early albums are rock and roll and soul records.
Yeah.
And some pretty obscure stuff.
So it was probably big for his music.
Yeah, yeah, very big.
You know, there was a big disconnect, I think. A lot of, probably with the 70s, just a lot of stuff got spaced. Oh, did you ever read this magazine, Goldmine?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I used to get it.
It might have been in there.
I would look, and it never popped up. Unless
it seemed most people were into minutia.
Yeah. Yeah, well, all the English people were buying up all these records, and they bought them all out of the American stores at the time.
Somebody told me it was Liverpool because Sailors would bring them back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and then a lot of stuff got released over there. Like obscure records like Watch Your Step actually got an English release.
We're going to play that.
Yeah.
Okay. What's that like?
It's kind of in the Ray Charles What I Say vein. And then Lennon also mentioned how the riff in I Feel Fine.
Oh, did he talk about him when he played him?
Yeah, he did. Okay. And he said, you'll hear where we got the inspiration for the I Feel Fine riff in this record.
Wow.
So Bobby Parker was a New Orleans cat who's still around and still playing from time to time.
Okay, this is... We'll be right back.
You're the sweetest
From Pedro Show, Derek here is going to tell you what we just played. We started with Watch Your Step by Bobby Parker.
Yeah, then after that you heard The Wooden Nickels with Nobody But You. The Wooden Nickels were an L.A. studio group put together for this one record with Brenda Holloway on lead vocals, which Brenda Holloway was signed to Motown at the time. She was the first L.A. artist signed to Motown.
I was going
to
ask if it was the L.A.
Yeah, yeah. Her and her sister would sing a lot of harmonies together, so that's her sister Patrice is on that record also, and that's just
And the band put it together because he goes to L.A. He didn't tell the Funk Brothers.
Yeah, this was a few years before that. This was Brenda Holloway.
You know about that when they moved? Like nobody told them.
Right, right, right. And everything really went to hell with Motown when they moved to L.A. Also.
But all those guys.
Yeah.
That great band that was on all those records was just like.
Right. This Wooden Nickels track is almost punk rock. It's so intense. It's just this raw, you know, just slamming track. So that's one of my favorites.
Who's in the Wooden Nickels, you know?
No, there's no session info.
Just like those Motown ones in Detroit.
Right.
I think Jamerson, somebody told me the first time his name was on a record was the Marvin Gaye.
Right. Thing. Yeah, that's true.
What's going on?
Yeah, Marvin insisted on that. Yeah, and then after that, you heard Give In from the Webs. The Webs were a great New York group that released a handful of singles. Then you heard The First Taste of Hurt by Willie T. Willie T is a New Orleans cat. Started out in jazz and then started into the R&B scene when he was very young. And a little bit of trivia, I took my pseudonym, my Derek C. pseudonym, in inspiration from Willie T. Willie T's real name was Turbinton. So, and he spelled it T-E-E, which I do the same with my last name. So
because if you only use the first letter, it
right.
would be T.
Right, right.
But yours is a little trippier.
Yeah, because my real last name is Cullimore.
No, but the C is the letter.
Yeah.
You use the
right,
word.
Right, right. A little sneakier, but fully fully inspired by Willie sure. T there. And that's one of his rarest sides. It came out on a New Orleans local label. And these guys were funny because he was signed to Capitol at the time. But he
just moused.
Yeah, he moused. Some of the copies say Willie Lee on the label.
Which
I think those are the ones that may have been nationally distributed, but the New Orleans ones say Willie
T. The Massey Hall thing, Charlie Parker's called Charlie Chan.
Really? Is it the same kind of deal?
Signed to another label.
Yeah.
I think it, because it came out on Mingus's label.
Huh. Yeah, that's a mouse.
A mouse.
All right, and the last track you heard in that set was Heart Trouble from the Parliaments. And there were earlier Parliaments cuts than that in the late 50s that were doo-wop records. Then there was a gap where there was nothing. But Heart Trouble signified the beginning of George Clinton's R&B era in Detroit as both a musician, writer, and producer. We're talking pre-Funkadelic. There was the Parliaments that released a number of singles, including I Want to Testify. It was a pretty big crossover hit. George Clinton also worked with J.J. Barnes, which I've got a J.J. Barnes track to play later that has some Clinton involvement. Then, just inspired by the MC5 and Hendrix and Stooges, Funkadelic came along
Maybe
later
Black
on.
Murda.
Yeah, Black Murda, another Detroit rock and roll band.
Supposedly the first all-black
right,
band.
Right,
because Jimmy had some guys from England who...
Yeah, that's an interesting story in itself.
Yeah, and me finding out about Edwin Starr.
Right, yeah. They
and playing behind him.
They played on some great Edwin Starr records, 25 Miles and Agent 00 Soul.
Yeah.
Really hard-hitting stuff. And so this next set, these are all records that are Detroit Soul records. And
well, let's get into this thing about, okay, so you hear this Bobby Parker song by John Lennon.
Yeah.
And you can't find it anywhere. So
right.
you're like all searching out because the Pete Gabriel don't sound too obscure. But did this experience with Mr. Lennon and his obscure thing like get you into this thing? Why not check out shit that ain't Mersh?
Yeah, well, there was quite a few years in between that, and you know, also during that period I got pretty big into punk rock and also hip hop all throughout the 80s. You know, I was living in LA and listening to KXLU and KROQ.
What, you wanted to see where the punk people and hip rap got where their influences were?
Yeah, I think that was part of it.
I was intrigued by that.
Yeah.
You know, like, because punk was like, wow, they're whittling things down. But maybe some of this kind of sound actually existed before, and it's a rediscovery. Not like they found them old records, but just this kind of sense of... getting back to, because they had to. It hadn't been refined yet. They weren't reacting against a stadium rock. There was no stadium rock.
Right, right.
So they're making their own records. But there's such a similarity between, God, when I got that first Jam album.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it sounded like, 60s music.
Yeah.
But they were young guys.
Yeah.
So this intrigued me about that because... I did get to really know about... I did know there seemed to be a lot of knowledge about people at punk gigs. Like these records Mr. Shaw put out. nuggets and pebbles.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were called garage bands. And, like, the punk bands were kind of garage bands, you know, because they were econo. And these people were putting out their own records, which I had no idea of, going to arena rock shows and only knowing major label.
Right.
And the same with the soul music. Maybe they weren't garage bands so much, but there was so much independent label.
Sure. And it was... I think the thing that always drew me to that, and then also going back to what I was listening to in the 80s, I was also buying the Nuggets records and all that stuff on Rhino and it, and everything. So it was just
the... Shaw was a bump.
Yeah, he was bump, and he was...
But he also signed some punk bands. He had some Stooges records.
Yeah.
And so I knew there was some kind of mixture.
Right.
It was strange in a way because there was a weird thing about hippies and... And, yeah, you could say 60s was hippies. But definitely it wasn't like 70s arena rock music.
Yeah, it was all coming from more of the gut than all the Mersch stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Then I remember D-Boom getting a jam single. Maybe around that time of that album. And it had, like, Midnight Hour on the other side or something live.
Yeah, they would do Heatwave. You know, they did Heatwave.
Well, The Who did Heatwave.
Right, which, yeah, their version is a lot like The Who's version. But, yeah, Weller's another, you know, he's a massive soul fan also, so...
Yeah, see? There was a weird connection, huh?
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the whole mod movement in England, you know, all of this stuff. Because the mods in 63, 64 were... R&B fanatics, you know, popping speed and dancing all night to these records.
There's this Who poster that has Pete, and it says Maximum R&B.
Right, right. That was their stomping music, and that was a huge influence on the British scene, which my theory behind it is why those bands were all so tight, because they were fully engrossed in the R&B music.
Where, and those cats played really tight.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So what's with the next batch?
We got some Detroit records. The first one I'm going to play, it's not necessarily a rare record, but it's, I think, unjustly obscure. And it features some of Jamerson's finest bass playing. Since I'm on the show of a fine bass player, I thought that I have a few songs with some excellent bass work. James Jamerson, of course, the Motown session man that... Highly influential. This is Martha and the Vandellas cut from 66 called Show Me the Way.
Okay.
I know you. Yeah, love.
I'll prove my love to you.
Ooh, love.
Alright, so that set started off with Martha and the Vandellas with Show Me the Way, and next was Crooked Woman by Ed Henry, then you heard Puppet on a String from Gino Washington, then Love is Like a Ramblin' Rose, yes, the same song that MC5 covered, that was by Ted Taylor, and after that you heard Love Can't You Hear Me from the Knight Brothers.
Ramblin' Rose, first song D. Boone learned on the guitar.
And we'll talk about
MC5 with that.
We'll talk a little bit more about these records in the next hour.
Yeah. Although we'll probably have another batch.
Yeah.
That's okay, right?
Yeah.
More talk. When was that one? That Ramblin' Rose?
66 for that one.
So that's before MC5.
Yeah, yeah. Now,
I wonder if they heard that.
Oh, yeah.
You said these are Detroit singles.
Yeah, Ted Taylor is a Detroit guy. And I played the Gino Washington track because Gino Washington was a big influence on Rob Tyner and the MC5.
Ah, big respect for Rob Tyner.
And this was the first single that Gino Washington cut for Correct Tone Records. He later redid Puppet on a String a few years later with Gino is a Coward on the Other Side, which is a great, great record. I strongly recommend seeking that one out. This one is very tricky to find, and it has a backing vocal group on the record called the Primettes that a few months later had their name changed to the Supremes.
Yeah,
but wow. You're not hearing Diana Ross in the lead. You're hearing Florence belting it out and sounding great. So,
yeah, it's the end of the first hour of Wild for Pedro show, August 10th, 2010. Hang tight for hour two. August 10th, 2010, second hour, the WAP from Pedro show. Here's more stuff from Derek C's collection.
Girl,
So our
Starting off the second hour.
Okay. Starting off the second hour, Never Let Your Love Grow Cold by the Vontastics. They're a Chicago group. A little bit of a psychedelic soul sound on that one. And that was followed by The Twilight Zone by the Astors.
Psychedelic, when was it?
67. Okay. Right in the okay. height of the psychedelic era. Vontastics also covered Day Tripper. Lots of soul bands were covering Beatles and Stones songs during that period. Then you heard The Twilight Zone from the Astors. The Astors were backed by...
What's that temp record? Solid Rock? When's that?
Solid Rock.
It's got Cloud Nine and Ball of
Confusion. Oh, yeah, 69 for that one.
Does anybody give a damn about the brothers back in Vietnam?
Yeah, yeah, that was Norman Whitfield was the producer. In fact,
when you open it up, it's a gatefold.
Mm-hmm.
He's in there.
Yeah, yeah.
You ever see that?
Yeah, he was a big part of that psychedelic soul sound.
And he wrote the Ain't No
Mountain High Enough?
No. It's on that record.
He wrote a lot of songs, and a lot of times in the... Ain't No Sunshine.
Sunshine when she's
Is that
gone.
On that record?
I think really? So. What was that web for? Let's see.
Yeah.
But it's funny, I remember opening up and there's a picture of him.
Yeah.
You don't really, you see the producer.
Right. So the Astors were backed by Booker T and the MGs, who are the house band at Stax. That's a Stax record.
Detroit.
And then after that you heard the Slow Fizz from the Sapphires, and then you heard two in a row with some Eddie Bow involvement. Eddie Bow started out in New Orleans in the mid-50s cutting rock and roll records, and gradually started incorporating some R&B into his sound. And then by the mid-60s, he was just this monster proto-funk soul man. Oh, yeah, there you go. It's been a while since I listened to that record. Yeah.
Yeah, and this cover. I mean, it's just too much, and then you open it up.
Yeah.
But no, you know what? It hasn't. It's maybe a year, because this is a bitchin' fucking record. Maybe it's got its song titles. No.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah, I have that one at home. So.
But why don't they list the song titles? Stop the War Now. It's Summer.
Yeah. Edwin Starr also did a great version of Stop the War Now.
Stop the War. Eddie Kendricks.
Mm-hmm. Before he went on his own.
Boogie. Keep on boogieing.
Keep on trucking.
Keep on trucking with that.
Yeah. All right, so you heard two Eddie Bow numbers. The first one was the Rubber Band Part 1. There have been
Was there a Spinners song?
Rubber Band Man, yeah, a little later on. Eddie Bow's had a big 70s. Resurgence, and a lot of his music's been reissued, but the Rubber Band is only available on a 45, and a very hard-to-find one at that, so that's a choice nugget for you. Courtesy of the Watt from Pedro show.
Thank you.
And that set ended with Chuck Carbo as produced by Eddie Bow with Can I Be Your Squeeze, which is just a
What brought
monster.
All them songs together?
Well, it's less of a theme with that set, other than the last two that are Eddie Bow tracks, but... Just kind of going a little more free form now.
That's right. So, you know, you're doing the one finger chord thing on the guitar.
Uh-huh.
When do you meet somebody in school you want to make a band with?
Yeah, that came a little later. When I was in middle school, the first band I put together, a friend of mine.
They didn't call it junior high? Am I that old?
Some when people call it junior high. Some call it middle school.
Well, it got changed in middle. My sister teaches that now. But
yeah.
We didn't. It wasn't called for us, but that's California.
And this was.
Yeah, you have some California years.
Oh yeah, yeah, Southern California, yeah. El Segundo.
What years?
82 to 88.
This period.
Yeah, yeah.
That early period when you're just picking up the guitar.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you want to start playing with other people?
Yeah, I met a friend
in eighth grade,
I think, and we were both kind of the class weirdos.
Yeah.
His name was Paul Graff. Paul Grafton, and he didn't play an instrument, but he
wants to be in a band.
Yeah, all yeah. Right. And I said, "Have you ever thought about playing bass?" He said, "Yeah, I'll play bass." So he saved up over the summer and bought a bass, and I started showing him root notes.
Eighth grade. What, you're 14?
I was a little younger, so 12 or 13. Then we just played music together, and then our freshman year in high school, freshman year in high school, we met a guy named Tim, who ended up becoming the third member of the triumvirate, and we formed a band called I Sharko that actually, after we graduated high school, recorded an album with Kramer from Shimmy Disc fame that was released by Bomp Records when we were about 19 years old. So that's kind of a psychedelic space rock record.
You stayed with the same guys from 8th grade after high school.
Yeah, and then we got back together sporadically.
This band, and that's your first band?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you guys are writing songs?
Yeah, you know, the whole thing.
What was the first song you wrote?
I honestly can't remember.
I can tell you mine.
Yeah.
I only wrote one as a teenager.
Yeah, what was it?
It was called Mr. Bass King Outer Space. It was about a bass player doing some big solo and blowing the other guys off. It was just terrible.
How much later was Tony Gets Wasted in Pedro?
With Punk.
Yeah, so a few years later.
So I'd say 78, 79.
Mm-hmm.
That's Reactionaries.
Yeah.
I think it's 78. But in 78, I'm 21.
Okay.
I'm going to be 21. I'm at the end of the year. So as a teenager, I only wrote one song. We never wrote songs. So I'm always interested in people who fucking wrote songs young, because I never got to do it.
We covered a lot of songs, too. You know, we'd cover Minutemen and Firehose songs. We'd cover Sonic Youth, Butthole Surfers, 13th Floor Elevators, Funkadelic. You know, just all of this weird stuff. All this weird, great stuff, you know. And people would say, you know, we're in a small town in Indiana outside of Chicago. And people would say, what is all this music you're playing? You know, and we'd make little mixtapes for them. Or I was actually the mixtape guy.
Okay.
So I would make all these mixtapes with all
of
these
you guys recording.
Of us and them.
Ghetto Blaster. You mean of the songs that you would end up covering.
Right. But we would make tapes, too, and distribute them around to our friends.
How'd you record?
I scored. No, we were lower.
Just a stereo machine turned on, right?
Yeah, I was also into tape machines, so I would find reel to reel tape machines at garage sales and things. And
we'd go into those.
Yeah, we'd hook up a couple mics and sing through whatever amp was available and just
sing through amps.
bash out all this kind of trashy stuff.
Do you have any of that?
I do. Yeah, somewhere in the archives. I'd record the gigs that way, too.
Oh, wow. You were doing gigs then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we started doing gigs when we were 14.
What were those like?
There was a place that was a roller rink that we used to play at that on weekends would have bands, and it would turn into a weird scene because there'd be all of these lame Nazi people there and, you know, the Nazi skinhead faction and all of this, but... You know, for us, it was great because, for the most part, those guys didn't mess with us.
Oh.
But we were, you know, we were meeting girls and doing all of this stuff, so it seemed like a pretty good life. And that's why at least I never stopped. I don't think those guys are playing a whole lot anymore, but
they were great.
They were great. It's too bad that they aren't really creative musicians.
Sharko.
Yeah.
Sharko.
Very,
so
very
did
silly.
Where'd you get that name?
I'm sure that there was some kind of bad behavior involved with it. You know, teenage guys hanging out doing God knows what.
And hey, let's call it Sharko.
Yeah.
Like you were sharks.
Right. Yeah, probably. And it stuck. You know, when we recorded that first album, we had a lot of people tell us, "Oh, change your name. That name is terrible." But we never did.
You didn't pick it from a list of names. It was
no.
just the first one.
Yeah.
Like, yep, that's
it. You know, we were big into bands like the Butthole Surfers and stuff like that. So we were thinking outside of the box.
You were 14 when you came up with that name. Was real early.
Yeah. Then we would do strange. We would do strange things like make flyers where we would call ourselves Iron Sharko Mama, but emphasize the I and the Sharko. You know, just to be
oh,
weird.
Is that why I said I Shark?
Yeah.
We got a band called the Bright Orange Band.
That's not bad.
Didn't write one song.
Was it one of those bands where you just get together with dudes and talk about being
No, we
a
played,
band?
We copied Creedence and Rolling Stone, Alice Cooper, Cream, Blue Oyster Cult. All real bad.
Yeah, of course. Well, our big thing... We
didn't write one fucking song. That Mr. Bass King Outer Space, I never showed it to anybody.
Yeah. Well, we would
never fucking play that song.
Especially early on, we would do things like... We'd say, hey, let's learn I Want to Be Your Dog. It's like, yeah, let's learn it. We would only learn the riff. I would learn the words, but we wouldn't learn the change. We would just play the riff for like 5 minutes, and I'd sing over it.
Oh, that's how we did it first with Smoke on the Water. We would just play that fucking riff over and over for hours.
Yeah.
American Woman. Don't. I mean, on and on and on. When we were like that age, 14. Yeah.
The kids
didn't have
it,
a name then. A Bright Orange Band came when we were 16. That was some other guy, too. He thought of, like, what you call it, a name. I mean, the arena rock had us so beaten down, we just never thought you could do gigs or anything. You couldn't play the arenas. We didn't know about clubs. There was keggers, but kegger guys could copy records good. They could play Black Dog. They could play Great White Buffalo.
Well, yeah, you guys, you know, of course, really paved the way for all the young bands like mine to be able to do that.
Yeah, well, this
thing.
Is when we're your age. I'm telling you. You're playing keggers in the backyard, and it was hard to copy some of that shit.
Yeah.
And some guys were better at it, obviously, than us. And us equipment was really bad. We didn't know about Fenders and Gibsons and
those
boxes. We didn't know about any of that shit. We thought it was all studio effects.
Yeah. When I was 15, I worked this summer painting a fence and bought a Les Paul with that money. And, you know, it was $300. I'll never forget it. No case. So I would walk around with this late 70s Les Paul Standard, no case, with just the worst PV amp. But I'd read that Steve Turner from Mudhoney was using two fuzz boxes. So I got a hold of two fuzz boxes, and I was completely happy with that sound.
Wow.
That was just fine for me.
We didn't even know about them. We didn't know what the fuck they were doing. So our guitars, people always sound like bells.
Yeah.
And then when punk came, he didn't use them again.
Right.
He used them on some leads on albums, but he never used them at gigs. What do you got in this next batch? What's the next song?
Our Love is in the Pocket from J.J. Barnes. This is a George Clinton production and co-writing number, so one of my favorite records.
Okay, this is...
But it's love beyond compare.
don't you know I need you, baby? You're by my side now. You know I want you, baby. Need you by my side.
Oh,
All right, so you just heard My Baby Likes to Boogaloo by Don Gardner, one of the rawest, most lo-fi records from the 60s. Sounds like there's one mic on everything, yeah. And Don Gardner's screaming on top of all of it. Just a fucking great record. Before that, you heard some L.A. soul.
But what was he about? Did he make other stuff?
He made some other stuff, but none of it was like that. This was a one-off kind of thing. All his other... He cut some other really good records, but more deep soul, whereas Baby Likes to Boogaloo is just an all-out wailer.
Yeah.
Before that, you heard some L.A. soul from the Isonics.
Did he do different stuff on different labels?
Yeah.
Or is this the only one for this label?
I think it's the only one for this label. There might be one other one, though, but lots of other labels.
What was the other side like?
Pretty forgettable. I haven't listened to it in years since I first got the record, so it's definitely one of those warm shots. This is actually a pretty well-known record with the soul scene. You know, you hear it a lot when dudes DJ out. Dudes and female DJs.
So this is what happened.
I'm sorry?
But some of these records, you're at a thing, and
yeah.
You're hearing dudes play records.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, let's just find that out.
Yeah, okay. And a lot of it's just from, digging and taking chances. Then before that, you heard the Isonics from Los Angeles with Sugar. And before that was Sam D's with Lonely For You Baby. My copy of that record looks like it was dragged behind a truck.
Why?
But it's just was played so
much.
I got that one off of eBay.
It's some dude who played it.
Yeah, it's one of those records that when it's really clean can easily sell for over $1,000.
Do you ever get records that can't be played?
45s almost always can be played. Like this one.
You never had one in the sun? I got a Rocky Erickson Bermuda one that I left with. What it was a curtain was left open.
Yeah.
The sun came through and it made it like a fucking... waffle.
Yeah, I've had that happen before, and that's a real bummer. With this stuff, if any of that ever happened, I'd be a wreck. But
did you ever try to iron them straight?
Iron doesn't work.
Yeah, I know. I tried it with that rock.
Yeah. Some people talk about using two pieces of glass and putting the record in between and putting it on low heat in the oven or out in the sun. You can't do that with most 45s because they're made with styrene and not vinyl. I did it once and the record turned into a shrinky dink, so I said never again. But the Sam D's record, I settled for a really low quality copy of it just because I wanted to have it and I didn't want to pay $1,000 for it. But
wow.
It still sounds good.
$1,000.
Yeah. There's records that go for five figures. It's
45s.
Yeah, not many sell for that much, but there's lots of them that are in the over $1,000 range. It's wild.
The quality good for that much money.
Yeah, but a lot of crazy people like me will settle for copies that are pretty rough just to have the record.
Are there people out there who find hard ones to find and then press them up?
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's real big, especially in England, and that's been going on since the early
70s. Randy Bachman, somebody told me that third or fourth Penguin was the real one.
The White Penguin, yeah, yeah.
He had bought a few, just put together things, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah, same kind of thing. There's,
does that happen?
Yeah, it's usually pretty easy to spot a counterfeit, though, because the way if you've been collecting records for a while, you can kind of tell by when they were pressed with the style of pressing and everything. See, this is getting into real geeky stuff here.
I'm curious. There's some fucking Dallas.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you're talking a really expensive record, it's scary. You want to make sure that it's the real thing that you're dropping that kind of dinero on. Before that, you heard the Vibrations with 'Cause You're Mine.
Because you know about these pebbles. I heard that some of those songs, there's no tapes. They were mastered off...
practically everything. Well, Greg Shaw didn't have the rights to do that stuff, so that was all taken off of his 45s. And if somebody came to him and said, hey, we want some, you put our record out, he'd say, okay, well, I'll send you some money. It usually wasn't very much. Greg Shaw, great taste, horrible business sense, and really screwed a lot of people over the way. But
you know what? Maybe it got people into some of that music
it did.
That wouldn't otherwise.
It did. That's a good thing about it because it certainly hipped me to a lot of stuff. Because
like right when a lot of those bands died, that scene died, it just
Mm-hmm.
I guess these DJ guys you hear play at gigs keep it living by playing the records.
Yeah, yeah, and definitely through my blog I try to keep the stuff alive.
Oh, yeah, we ain't talked about that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I do a 45 of the day blog, Derek's Daily 45.blogspot.com. It's been going for close to 4 years now.
So there's 1,300 of them?
Yeah, they're not all. I can only keep them up for about 2 months because of bandwidth. And also, honestly, having so much stuff up there for download, I'm kind of afraid that somebody's going to come after me.
No, but what about just having this spiel?
Oh, the spiel stays up.
The spiel stays up.
Yeah, that stays up.
See, because that's what I'm saying, the interest, you're letting people know.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody's talking about it, you might not have the thing, but then they might go on to search it because of something you wrote about it.
Yeah, yeah, and I have, it's kind of discreet on the site, but it says if there's anything that you want to hear from the past, just let me know and I'll send it to you.
Well, I'm kind of talking about, you found out. A lot of people, they don't really... What are resources?
A lot of people put stuff up on YouTube. You'll see a picture of the record spinning and with the audio or photos. So that's a good resource. A lot of sellers on eBay will post sound samples, which I found a lot of stuff. Goldmine's pretty much done.
Done, right?
Yeah, sadly. But I used to.
And why did that
I loved
happen?
It. Internet. Internet killed it. Yeah. Record shows are another good place. A lot of the dealers will have a portable record player out there so you can check stuff out. Same thing with record stores. They'll have stuff and have a turntable set up.
There's no problem with independent record stores. There's lots of those.
Oh, yeah. They're everywhere. And I do, especially when we're out on tour, I make lists of favorite places to visit and take pictures of the shop, and I'll do a write-up for that city. So...
Is it better over here or in the U.S.?
It's incredible over here.
And the U.S. is kind of troubled?
Well, luckily in my area, there's lots of good stores in the San Francisco Bay Area. Major cities still have good independent stores. I hear about, some stuff in remote places, but, of course, the Internet and big box evil conglomerates like Best Buy have killed a lot of stores. I worked in a record store in the 90s and just watched Best Buy just destroy us. So it's a real sad, sad deal. So back to that last set. Before Sam D's, you heard The Vibrations with 'Cause You're Mine.
Yeah.
And the set started out with J.J. Barnes.
What about Vibrations?
Vibrations were a long-running soul group from Chicago. And this was not one of the last, but towards the end of their career, and it's a real hard driving kind of proto funk record. And Bernard Reed, who is a pretty well respected bass player, was a permanent member of the Vibrations. And
how long did you live in Chicago?
I never lived in the city of Chicago. I lived in Valparaiso, Indiana, which is about 45 minutes away. Yeah, quite a number of years, from 1989 to 2004. Quite a while. 15 years. Then back to California.
Yeah. And what we start the second hour with?
Starting the second hour with what's probably my favorite 45 ever made. I don't like to pick favorites, but this one could very well be the favorite. This is I'm a Good Woman from Barbara Lynn. Barbara Lynn Ozen was a left-handed female guitarist, singer-songwriter who started making records when she was 19 and just an absolute trailblazer for women in music. Beaumont, Texas. And worked a lot in Louisiana with the producer Huey Moe.
Yeah, because that's Eastern Texas. That's right by the border.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal song, and her guitar playing just drives this track, and it's just a monster. 1967.
Wow. Damn. Okay. After iShark, our Sharko.
Yeah. Musically?
You still playing music, right? Those guys stop in Indiana.
Yeah.
You go back to Cali.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was in another band in Chicago shortly before I moved to California called Resplendent. that made an album called I Am Free that was a Pitchfork magazine favorite and a record I'm actually very proud of. It was a band that was started out as just
Pitchfork
myself.
Pitchfork Chicago?
Yeah, it's that, you know, hipster webzine kind of thing. And it was myself and a fellow named Michael Lindsay, who was in The Fire Show and also Number One Cup. And we did some different stuff. He really pushed me to play guitar differently, and I was
doing
what
happened to Sharko?
Sharko just kind of fizzled out.
Okay.
And, you know, that was that. So
I was also looking for new people?
Not so much, because I was doing a lot of, I was playing in Resplendent, and then I was
but how'd you get into Resplendent, I mean?
I'd met him a few years earlier and actually went on tour with those guys, kind of helping out and doing sound and, you know, that kind of thing. And then when the Fire Show fizzled out, he started doing this Resplendent project and got me involved. And I'm very, very proud of that album, which I think he has up available for a free download. If you look, you know, do a Google search for Resplendent, I Am Free. It's a good deal. Then moved to California and met up with a good friend and musical collaborator named Paul Kimball, and we have a band called Careless Hearts. And I'm also, that's kind of a roots rock band with an R&B and psychedelic edge. And I also play in a band.
You made an album.
Yeah, we made a couple albums. And we also worked with James Williamson of Stooges.
And there's a live thing.
Yeah, we did a live album, which was James' first gig in 35 years. And I'm also in a band with my lady friend called The Bang, and we do a recreation of the 60s girl group sound. And funnily enough, I'm a Good Woman is one of the songs that we do. So that's the one you're going to be hearing next.
Because I was going to say, we're not into the girl groups.
There's there some coming.
Okay.
Yeah.
You leave your home for days and days, and I know you got another woman somewhere around. Treat me like dirt. I don't go nowhere. You don't take me out. If I put on a nice dress, baby, you wanna start a fight. Even my next door neighbor notice the shape I'm in. Even my so-called friends. Now I know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna move away from here and pretend that I have happiness. Yes, I know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna leave you. Change gonna come.
All right, so you just heard two in a row there. That was started out with I'm a Good Woman from Barbara Lynn, which I was saying was probably, when push comes to shove, my favorite 45 ever.
Did you guys cover that in the
band? Yeah, we do. And once again, Barbara Lynn, pioneering singer, songwriter, and female guitarist.
Yeah.
Just, you know, she's really one of the first of her type. And after that, you heard some more.
What was this lady, Minnie?
Oh, Memphis Minnie?
Memphis Minnie.
Yeah, yeah, going way back. Yeah, yeah. There was a long gap. She was 20s.
I know.
There wasn't a whole lot in between. Yeah, yeah, Memphis Minnie, when the levee
breaks. I played some of her stuff.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe it. And what's the other one?
Hide and Seek from Lillian Dupree, with one of my favorite intros out of any of these 45s.
Where was she from?
Detroit.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
We're at the end of the second hour of Watch for Pedro Show, August 10th, 2010, here in Oslo, Norway. And there's a bike race going on. It's not a certain kind of rally. So don't be confused. Hang tight for hour three, please. August 10th, 2010, it's the third hour of the Watch for Pedro Show.
Just can't please you. Oh, little girl.
Watch for Pedro show.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So in that set, we started out with Lonnie Lester. Lonnie Lester was a guy who's actually still active in Indianapolis, Indiana. When he recorded this single and two others, he was in Gary, Indiana.
North.
Yeah, right by where I used
to
live.
Okay.
Yeah.
Willie Waldman, the trump player for Banyan, is up that way.
Really?
Yeah, he beekeeper.
Yeah, most people went to Chicago to record, you know, yeah, with VJ and those labels. But Lonnie Lester recorded in Gary and released these records on his own. And
really?
Yeah, yeah.
Was that common?
It was very common.
We were talking in the boat about, because of that fucking storm.
Mm-hmm.
People in Finland, it was a bad scene.
Yeah.
Not because of Finland, but a freak storm came up and, wow. But we're, you know, Mr. Mayfield was hit by a light scaffold in the last 9 years of his life. He's paralyzed. But early in his life, right after Impressions, I think maybe even in Impressions, he started putting out his own records on Kurtdom.
Yeah, yeah, and he actually
had... And he put out other people!
He did. He had two labels before that as well.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, he during the Impressions era.
Even during the Impressions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was quite the entrepreneur.
Yeah, because some of these bands were happening on his label, too.
Yeah, the Five Stair Steps, and they were a big one.
Oh, shit. I can't remember. You know, Staple Singers.
Yeah, he did some Staple Singers.
You know, I had that album, Curtis Live.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great album.
And, man, that was a bitchin' record. It's got one weird song, We've Only Just Begun. But yeah.
I admit it, I like his version. Well, I like that song. Yeah.
He's sincere about it. Yeah. He's sincere about it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, people get readies on it. Mighty, Mighty, Spade and Whitey, If There's Hell Below.
He released a great album.
Staples, yeah. Staples Singers, Baby Huey and the Babysitters, which was Chaka Khan.
Really?
Yeah. She was in the band at that time.
I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, that Baby Huey album that Kurtdom released is just absolutely incredible.
I mean, but this cat, I'm getting ahead of myself because I wanted you to talk about all these things, but I wanted to talk about, because you talk, it's the same, this cat was putting out his own records.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to ask you, of all this stuff you've been playing, how much stuff is on the same label? It's almost a different label for every one of these.
Yeah, practically different labels for everything. You know, there were a lot of things up. There were a lot of independent producers, like the guys that own the Revelot label, which J.J. Barnes and the Parliaments recorded for. There'd be, you know, a couple producers that owned a label like that. There'd be offshoots of labels like OK, which was part of Epic, that released a lot of soul records. Eddie Bowe owned his own labels. A lot of artists and a lot of producers would scrape together money and put these records out. Sometimes they get national distribution.
Yeah, I was going to ask about
that. Sometimes they get picked up.
What I heard about with maybe a garage band, maybe not the soul thing, it had to stay regional.
Yeah, yeah.
It couldn't go.
Well, the soul records were real popular on jukeboxes. So there, you could have a record that didn't chart, but it would be a big hit in jukeboxes.
Playing in the bars.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a much stronger distribution aspect for a lot of these records.
Even so, them being a little late.
Yeah, yeah. They'd end up in odd places. Because I found some rare records in just the weirdest places where you'd never expect it. So they got around.
And maybe the big radio was getting the big labels.
Yeah, I think that the distributors were more likely to take independent releases at this time because the biz hadn't really taken over, so nobody knew what the next hit was going to be.
Ah.
You know, they figured, well, we could have another Motown on our hands.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah. So after Lonnie Lester, you heard Jimmy Robbins with I Can't Please You. Jimmy Robbins, I believe, owned the label that released that record, and that became a relatively small but still a national hit. And after that, you heard Edwin Starr with You're My Mellow. which was his last record before he went on to Motown. And
everybody, you know his big song, it was called War.
Edwin Starr had a real stellar career with just one great single after another. You're My Mellow is one of the tougher ones to find, which is why I picked that one for this show.
Before.
Yeah, 1968. And after that, you heard Belita Woods with Grounded. Got another George Clinton.
Yeah, you had a theory. It might be Mike Mirda playing behind him.
Yeah, on You're My Mellow, it's probably...
It's not Mirda, by the way, because they spell it the same for the fucking turds and shit over, you know, it's up Latin. I think Merida in Spanish, Mirda, no, Mirda in Spanish, Merida in French, Mirda in Portuguese, but they actually were called Black Murder and then just wanted to spell it a little different.
Yeah, not
so the
very,
word is murder. Murder.
Not very commercially viable.
Yeah,
there.
I know. But I heard it was because, KKK killings in Detroit.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a southern thing.
Right, right.
Which I think some people, well, you, Indiana, you should know that
they had
more congressmen in that were Klan.
Yeah, it's one of the many reasons why I'm so happy to not be in that state anymore.
Got them out. There was some scandal. I think they killed one of their secretaries. But I'm talking about in the 20s and stuff.
I think they're still just, around.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
They're still around.
But I think Branford Marcellus is in the music department at IU and stuff.
Oh, really? Well, so that's a step in the right direction. So yeah, after Edwin Starr, you heard Belita Woods with Grounded. Belita Woods...
Yeah,
That's an early track from her. That's 67. She's been part of the touring Parliament Funkadelic lineup for many years, and just a real powerful voice.
Yeah.
And that set concluded with another wailer from Irene and the Scots, I'm Stuck on My Baby. It's a Chicago soul track from 66. And
what about Sam Cooke?
Sam Cooke is acknowledged as being the kind of the founder of the soul sound and taking gospel and fusing it with
R&B.
Well,
then what about that Spot said he got a tick. He lived on the same block as Ray Charles. He lived on the same block as Spot. And Spot told me he got a ticket for speed.
Ray Charles did, right.
And because he reworked some of his stuff. They say that was maybe some of the first soul.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. You listen to a record like What I Say from 59,
right.
And man, that's soul music to me.
Yeah. But Sam Cooke, too.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Sam when Cooke, they start calling it that.
Yeah, and then Sam Cooke was one of the first to cross over, also.
Yeah,
to the white audiences. Yeah, yeah, beautiful music.
I think it got shot at a motel or something.
Yeah, shot by the motel owner. Real tragic story.
A great singer.
Yeah, one of the best.
So before that, they called it R&B?
Yeah, which that name still sticks today.
Yeah. But do they still say soul?
Well, you hear neo-soul a lot. And then cats like Raphael Sadiq that are really doing a 60s soul sound.
So they're bringing it back. Did that mean soul died? What killed soul?
Well, what did kill soul? I think that
curious.
My theory on it is the same thing that killed the great rock and roll of the 60s. I think business took the music over. Less people were allowed to make chances, and it just became more and more commercial. And also by the end of the 60s, politically, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy killed. So this era of this uplifting era where there was social liberation for so many people, you know, it seemed like it was, you know, it was over. Of course, I wasn't alive then, so I'm just going off of
you know
what I've learned.
These
but
records are all before you're alive.
The records kind of tell the story.
Now, what about some of the singing style though? What about a band like Hall & Oates?
I don't even know. Well, the interesting thing about
Daryl
those
Hall,
guys,
doesn't
he
have kind of a soul voice?
Yeah, Daryl Hall had a record in Philadelphia in the late 60s, it's quite valuable. You know, an interracial band.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, his singing reminds me of soul singing.
Yeah, and they cut, you know, they cut some covers like Backfield and Motion and stuff like that, but really slickified it and took out the edges.
Okay, what about a song like Kung Fu Fight? Would you call that song?
I wouldn't. I think that's kind of a...
Because, you know, what most people would say, my guess is if I asked about it, they'd say, oh, disco killed song.
But yeah, I think that's...
I'm not saying I'd say that.
It's pretty accurate. I think that's pretty accurate. Because, you know...
It seemed like disco still had some good singers, but it got... the music got...
The songwriting...
For dancing?
Yeah, the songwriting element kind of went away in the disco years. But really, the trends in music changed. In the early 70s, you hear a lot more of the sweet soul sound, where the harmony groups, which is beautiful stuff, but it didn't quite have the edge that the 60s music did. And then the edgier stuff tended to be funk, you know, where the beat's on the one instead of the four on the floor soul beat. So, take a combination.
When I was in junior high school, what was his name? Tex.
Joe Tex?
Joe Tex.
Yeah. Yeah, he
what
was
did
one.
You call that?
Well, Joe Tex had a long,
there
long
career.
There
was a song
career.
Called I Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a funky song.
It's in the middle 70s.
Yeah, that was 72 for I Gotcha.
Was that a 72? Yeah. Okay, early 70s.
So he started out.
Yeah, I was in junior high school then.
He started out in the 50s with raw R&B records, then soul in the 60s, and then kind of went funk and disco in the 70s.
Yeah, but that's something. It's almost got them changes bass line.
Yeah. That's a cool song. Yeah. So I don't know. I think there's been a resurgence in the last few years, and I certainly hope to see more of a resurgence.
And the Marvin Gaye, he's killed in the early 80s.
Yeah.
His father, I was working in the neighborhood he was killed in.
Yeah, that was...
Crenshaw. Worked for an old lawyer named Mr.
Horrifying.
But he hadn't really been doing some good records.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up another interesting point. I've been focusing on a lot of obscure and rare stuff on the show, but the hits through the era were phenomenal. And, you know, the Motown hits, the Stax hits, Atlantic Records... It's some of the, to me, it's music music doesn't get any better than those records. You think of Otis Redding and Aretha and, you know, the Martha and the Vandellas, Temptations. It's just
Otis Redding was pretty rowdy music.
Yeah. Very.
It's pretty intense.
Yeah. Great stuff. So, shall we play a few more?
Yeah. I'm just curious about this stuff.
Yeah.
This thing about little labels.
It's kind of punk rock.
Yeah,
really.
I know. Yeah. I see some interesting parallels. What do you got? What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear one from the 3 Degrees. Are You Satisfied?
Now Yeah.
Okay, Derek, what do we hear?
All right, you just heard Blowing Up My Mind by the Exciters. And before that, you heard Lou Courtney with Hey Joyce. That song is especially interesting because that was one of the songs that was very influential on hip-hop because there's two drum breaks. And in the early days of hip-hop dancing, the B-boys would stand with their arms folded and wait for the drum break in the song. And when the drum break came on, they'd go out and do their kind of early break dancing. And so any song with a drum break was big with those guys. And Hey Joyce has two, and that break's been those breaks have been sampled a lot and used in a lot of hip hop songs. And before that, you heard The Epitome of Sound with You Don't Love Me. And this record was a big mystery, and for many, many years, it's a song that was. It's been played on the soul scene for years and years, since the early 70s, and nobody knew about the band. I posted the record up on my blog, and within about a month, I heard from the guy that was the singer who wrote to me, which was just one of the most touching things. I've had this happen a few times, but with this one, it was the coolest because there was no information on the band. Everybody thought
Where
it was.
Where were they from?
They're from New York. Everybody thought it was a white band. It was a white band with a black singer. So they
like
were
Village People.
They were yeah. Well,
no, there's an Indian.
Yeah,
in that
right. So mystery solved on The Epitome of Sound, and he sent me a picture of the band even.
What, they're still around?
No, they're not around anymore, but this was their promo shot.
Even in the old days, there wasn't even a picture.
Right, right.
Wow.
It was a big mystery. So that was one of the real proud moments I
had.
What
was the label?
Sandbag Records.
Sandbag.
Yeah. another one-off.
So did he tell you the story?
He did, and I'm trying to get an interview out of him. Just a really nice guy named Gene Thomas, and he's become a web friend. And one of these days, I'll do an interview.
Yeah, what's the story? Is that the only record they made?
I believe it's the only record he ever made. But he still sings. He sings in his church, and that to me is that's really makes me really happy when I get those kind of messages. Like, you know, I'm still singing. You know, I may not be making records, but I still sing. You know, that's very touching
to
hear that.
What year was that record?
68. And before that, we heard Luther Ingram with If It's All the Same to You. This was the first record that Luther Ingram made. He later went on to Stax in Memphis in the early 70s and some smoother sounds, but that's a real rough-edged record. Yeah, smooth. And we started off with the 3 Degrees, who also went real smooth in the 70s, and they were even on Sanford and Son once. That's a real... real stomper from them called Are You Satisfied? So I got another one lined up here for as we were talking about Joe Tex.
Yeah.
This is
I just remember that song, you know, and it was early 70s. But it sure wasn't a disco song. Jesus.
This is one from 63 called Don't Play.
And it's Joe?
Yeah, Joe Tex.
Oh, cool.
Let me tell you, pretty baby, do you know what you're getting into? If you are gonna be my little girl, I won't have no stuff out of you. But mama, don't play. Oh, I said I don't play. You know I laugh at some jokes told by some funny folks, but listen, baby, I don't play. Tell you how much I'm against playing, and baby, please hear what I say. I quit school in my very first grade, 'cause they had recess every day. You know I don't play. Oh, I said I don't play. You know I laugh at some jokes told by some funny folks, but listen, baby, I don't play. Play. Well, I
say that I wasn't like the other boys. I hated playing so doggone much, I told my daddy not to buy me no toys. Now, woman, I don't play. You can tell by that I don't play. Well, you know, I laugh at some jokes, told by some funny folks. But listen, baby, I don't play.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. It is not dying, it is not dying. Lay down all thoughts, surrender to the void. It is shining, it is shining. Yet you may see the meaning of within. It is being, it is being. Love is all, and love is everyone. It is knowing, it is knowing. And ignorance and hate mourns the dead. It is believing, it is believing. But listen to the color of your dream. It is not leaving, it is not leaving. So play the game, existing to the end of the beginning, of the beginning, of the beginning.
Yeah, so it was tricky picking these songs for this show because there's so many records that I love that I would like to feature, but this was...
No, we're going to do another one. We've got more gigs coming up.
All right.
Don't worry. This is very interesting. Thank you so much,
well,
Derek.
Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure. So this last set, we started out with Joe Tex, Don't Play. Then you heard the Bobettes with I Gotta Face the World. Yes, the same Bobettes that recorded Mr. Lee in the late 50s. This is a complete 360 and a real hard-edged soul track from them. Then you heard My Heart is in Danger from Alder Ray. Then another New Orleans cut from Betty Harris with the Meters backing her up with There's a Break in the Road. And you heard Barbara Mason with You Better Stop It. And closing it out is a meditative, beautiful version of Tomorrow Never Knows by Junior Parker.
Well, that version is.
Yeah.
The song.
Right. His version is.
It's a cover.
It's interesting because, well, it's
I guess
interesting.
It was George Harrison, right?
That's Lennon.
This
Tomorrow
is Lennon?
Never Knows. Yeah. Junior Parker.
Oh, All Too Much is George.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And Junior Parker sounds like a very wise old man on this record, and months later he died. Yeah.
Do you know I did this song mixed with Glass Onion with Steve Shelley called Lucky Sperms?
Oh, I have that. Yeah, I have that record that I bought way back then.
I like these words, and let me put it over this music.
Yeah.
And I did like eight basses and spilled the wrong words from another, you know, from Glass Onion.
Yeah, that's a cool record. Still got that.
He's playing with the Noi guy now, Steve Shelley.
Really?
Not Dinger, he passed away.
The guitarist.
Yeah. Look, I want to thank you so much, and you're going to be on again, because I want to hear more and more of these records. And people, search this stuff out. This is one of the reasons why punk movement happened in my time, was because what these cats were doing in the 60s.
Yeah, there's a world of great music out there from so many different places.
Yeah. Big respect. Thanks for having your stuff aboard on my little boat here.
My pleasure, man.
Okay. You're a beautiful person, Eric. Thank you. It's August 10th, 2010, Watt for Pedro show. Keep your powder dry.